Hello there, and welcome to the Thinky Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and I'm joined by Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Scott Keith, and Adam Francisco. This is the, if you're listening to this, the Tuesday after Here We Still Stand. And I yet again want to remind people that if you would like to join us next year, now is your soonest opportunity to buy tickets for next year's conference. This isn't an attempt to just sell a lot of tickets. We really do just have a max number of people who can attend, and so that's part of it, is just, you know, hitting this head count, and once it's closed, it's closed. And so, the earlier you're in, basically, if you went to look to go buy tickets right now, you'd be guaranteed to be able to come. That's what I'm saying. So if you'd like to join us, you didn't have the opportunity this year, now's a good time to start looking into that. You can make plans a whole year ahead, which can definitely make plane tickets and the like cheaper.
I mean, my talk was pretty good this year, so I can't guarantee next year, although my talk hasn't happened yet.
No, your talk hasn't happened yet. Oh, so, okay. Adam, was your talk good this year as well?
Sorry, I was just about ready to cough. You caught me in a really bad spot. I'm not doing a talk this year.
Well,
good heavens.
Regardless of who talked in and when, whether it happened, will never happen, or happened again, you should join us. It's a good time. We do a lot of basically this at the conference. We go to breakouts and plenaries, and then we go sit outside and we have sort of fun, goofy conversations around good food and drink. I think it's one of my favorite times of the year, and that's a hard thing to say about theological conferences, actually. A lot of times it's sort of dry and filled with bad coffee, and this is the exact opposite of of that. So if you're looking to just sort of have a fun vacation, I think... In San Diego, visiting California is great, even if you never want to live here. So that's sort of one of the things.
It's the best way to see California as a visitor.
Yep, so... oh, gosh. But... again, I'll put the show note. I'll put a link in the show notes to the tickets that will go on sale for 2020. The topic will be the freedom of the Christian. I actually believe I have a breakout in 2020. At least I got an email about it. So maybe they'll weed me out before then. But yeah, I think
we'll
that'll be
that.
Fun. Adam's gonna be also have a breakout again in 2020. I know that for sure. And
maybe this year too.
And maybe this year too. We'll find out for certain. This is also like episode 6 in a series of relaxing the Thinking Fellows a little bit. We went through a series of a long time of formality, and we've been just trying to have more fun lately. I think that's what happens is we start to have like done so many topics so many times over and over again. Adam's not talking this year, is he?
No.
Was right. Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, just come hang out with Adam.
I'd be happy to do it, but yeah. It was kind of a surprise.
Either way. But we have the pipes going today, a little Maker's Mark, a little gin. I think it's...
In fact, gin with iced tea is very tasty.
Interesting. I wouldn't have admitted that on air, but
okay.
Well, I don't know if that's a good combo or not.
Black and bitter coffee.
Yeah,
that's what I stick with.
Well, getting past all of the nonsense and to do what we're actually here to do. Today we're going to talk about religious language and language games, meaningless statements. All of this sort of is going to fall under a similar theme. And we've done episodes that have touched on all of these before. We did an episode on analytic, synthetic, and meaningless statements before. I think we've talked about language games. I know even just a couple weeks ago, Dr. Keith, my dad, just talked about religious language really briefly. He used an example that Autumn had brought to you, I think. But we're going to sort of combine those into one episode today. I thought it was important. I see this happening online quite a bit on Facebook and Twitter. You'll see people make what would be classified as a meaningless statement. And I have found out the hard way that if you go in there and you comment and you say, this is a meaningless statement, that really makes people mad. The word meaningless carries quite a bit of weight for people when you're not trying to insult them, but you're just trying to say not making a point about anything.
Well, the way we're going to do it, it comes from the period following World War II and was building toward it before the war was over with, but we're using it in a technical way. That is, that it is the opposite of that doesn't mean anything to me. It's right. a technical use of the word meaningless from the way they constructed it, that there are legitimate propositions, and we'll tell you what they are and what they include, and then there are propositions that are neither analytic nor synthetic, and we're going to say they don't even rise to the level of falsity. That would be progress. Mm. Yeah. They're beneath that.
They're completely unverifiable.
Yeah.
You
in principle, you yeah. couldn't bring evidence to bear either way.
At best, it's a statement of feeling or emotion
yep.
or affect or something like that.
Yep. So it's a technical use of meaningless. They coined it.
Yeah, it's not an insult of,
no.
about the person.
No.
Which is,
nor is it your autobiography. That doesn't mean anything to me.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that can get caught up here if you sort of call people out on this kind of thing is you're actually trying to say I would love to have a conversation about this topic, but there's nowhere to go
uh-huh.
if we're gonna, you know, if the conversation is the universe loves me or something like that.
I think a good example of it is I was at dinner with our good friends Kurt and W. Winrich the other night. And we were talking about this kind of thing, and he relayed a Ravi Zacharias story where Ravi was teaching somewhere, and afterwards a lady came up to him and said, I don't know, I feel like love is so much more important than truth. And Ravi looked at her and said, really? Is that true? You know, and
Ravi Zacharias is really good with those sorts of comebacks.
It's an illustration of, you know, love is more important than truth is sort of a meaningless statement. Argue for or against that? What evidence would you levy in favor of that statement? You couldn't. It's meaningless in that sense, and that's why Ravi asked her, really, is that true?
I think, too, if you take this a lot of steps further, you're sort of pitting the person, love and truth, against himself, which is kind of, as a Christian, sort of it's not even a good, a theological dilemma to have if you sort of follow the words of Scripture and what Christ says about himself.
Well, what they illustrated with back then was a meaningless statement. An illustration of it would be creech, creech, creech.
Every once in a while, I get a text from a friend that you trained. It just says, creech, creech, creech. It's still an inside joke. Now, you keep on referring to they. You're talking about logical positivists,
yes,
broader analytical.
And the early Wittgenstein, yeah. Okay. And they never could understand why he didn't join up. Hmm. And I think the reason Wittgenstein never joined up was that they were tighter than he was. They wanted to get every single thing screwed down.
Yeah, yeah.
And Wittgenstein wasn't like that. He was more humble.
Hmm. Hmm. So you said you wanted to you actually said this a couple of weeks ago, like as soon as we turned off the mics, something had, I don't even remember, brushed up against this topic. You know, I really want to do an episode on.
Did I? That's interesting.
Religious language. And I sort of remembered that while we were in the...
So Rod used to teach a class at Concordia that he will almost not admit to teaching because he hated the class so much, called 20th Century Theology. Used a textbook, Grenz and Olson, 20th Century Theology, yeah, where basically it was a primary source reader from 20th century theologians of kind of every stripe, liberal, mostly liberal and neo-Orthodox mm-hmm. in there. But he would start that class with, you know, because you could, that was one of the first classes I took at Concordia. But I knew almost nothing. And so the fact that...
Did you come in as a transfer?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The fact that Rod sort of started that class with a broad... you know, 30,000-foot view of, I'd say, mostly post-World War I sort of mm-hmm. theological movements was helpful. And it's been helpful to me ever since. Just as a teaching tool, I've sort of started using that broad, sweeping 30,000-foot view historical intro to things because it's... you can. It's good to do because you're never getting so specific that you're going to be really, really wrong about something. And one, it for people that don't know anything, it sort of helps. And I mean, he can do it, or I could do what I remember of it. So,
I guess one of my questions would be, how do you, in this sort of critique, how do we deal with things that are, in fact, like emotions, for instance, so say, or even something central to the Christian faith, the statement, you are forgiven. What changes that from not being meaningless?
Well, back up a sec. I think it's important to get a bit of this sort of 30,000 foot view and to sort of, and you can get some of this even in C.S. Lewis when he does Surprised by Joy a little bit, because most of this sort of religious language kind of stuff originated in Europe and made its way, Rod had often said that it made its way to America through PhD, American PhD students who did PhDs in Germany. And it, you know, in Europe after, you could just sort of broadly say probably after the world wars, you had a society that was, you know, they were pretty broken. And Adam could say the history. I mean, Europe has, prior to that, is sort of like this series of Europe losing a third of its population time and time and time again to wars, many of which are religious wars.
And there's ever-present reminders, not just in physical destruction, but like shell shock, for example, right after World War I, men walking down the street in squares were pacing back and forth. I mean, men with a quarter of their head missing.
Right.
And it was, I mean, there's a, if you go to just say, let's say 1913 and kind of gauge the culture, it's very optimistic across Europe.
Yep.
1914,
1918. Yep. Yeah. First World War.
It's
not anymore.
Yeah.
Optimism is gone. And so there is sort of, and again, Adam can do this better, but there's sort of like pre-World War I, I mean like post, I don't want to say like Napoleonic Wars, but kind of post-Napoleonic Wars to like the World War I, you know, there's a bit of a lull in Europe, and this is, and you do get a very positive sort of movement where man thinks that they can sort of solve all the problems of the world with technology and education.
Yeah, and the beginnings of a World War I, one liberal theologian said, I cannot communicate to you what it was like to be living in that age where a world war we knew was impossible.
Right. Yeah, and so theologically before that, you have this movement starting, which we now call theological liberalism, right, where you very positive view of man's sort of contribution to things, very low view of miracles. You're like, you're deep into the Enlightenment here, and what we can discover through science is more real than anything that we could discover
any other way.
Some strong materialism.
Yeah.
Yes.
And this is the sort of predominant view. And so you have theologian after theologian who, I mean, they don't believe in the resurrection, you know, because they know that such a thing can't happen.
Yep.
I'd say if you were to study in Europe to this day and take a theology degree, you will likely have several professors who to this day don't believe in a physical resurrection.
I'd place a bet on that even.
Yeah.
Not just likely, I guarantee.
Yeah. Would. I mean, I did, for sure. I know Adam did. I know Rod did. You probably do.
I have encountered it, yeah.
And so, but then the World War is hit. And, you know, all these theologians who had such a high view of man and high view of technology, you know, and scientific development and progress, encounter a world that's literally destroyed because of that scientific progress and man's corrupt nature to use it on other men just in a fashion that to that point had not been seen before.
Yeah,
I mean, it's not like there hadn't been wars and the people hadn't died of war and pestilence and everything, but just millions and millions and millions.
That kind of scares, I mean, relatively speaking, scares me about our present time. You said this, like, this optimism.
Yes.
Especially towards technology and things like that. our ability to solve all the problems that we face sort of like without question. That's definitely one of the, you know, common threads in today's sort of Western society.
Right.
Yeah. You mentioned the word low anthropology, the sort of notion that man is perfectible.
Yes.
In some sense.
And they ought to work towards that.
Yeah. Yep. I think that underpins this optimism and progressivism. You find it back at least in the American scene, the Second Great Awakening back in the mid 1800s.
Sure. I mean, you saw it politically, you see it hardcore in the 20s in the United States.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And in Europe, it was Hegel who sort of represented the whole century in its optimism. And the goal was the spread of freedom, whatever he meant by that.
That's a good question. but anyway, so, you know, theological liberalism holds all the ground for the most part in Europe. World wars happen, probably specifically after World War I. Rod would have to help me more and Adam with the dates. But you do then get this movement of theologians who are sort of woken up by the atrocities and the horrors of that war.
Bart said it was really hard to preach what he was trained in seminary on the perfectibility of man when the artillery was going off in the next mountain.
Yeah. And so this generation of theologians who we've come to call the neo-Orthodox or the new Orthodox come about, and they, you know, they're not theological liberals, even though they maintain a lot of the categories. I think it's fair to say that this is where the what I call sort of religious use of language, as far as I understand it, sort of makes its debut, because you have a group of theologians who they're trained in liberal theology and they have a very hard time with a real historical, in the way we would understand history, resurrection and other miracles.
Mm-hmm.
And so they create this idea of two types, at least two types of language, I would say, religious and everything else. Religious language is real, quote unquote, just not in the sense that it's verifiable, like a historical event in the way that we would understand history.
And so you get two types of truth, right? You sort of get a verifiable one and one that's
two types of history.
Yeah,
two German words.
Mm-hmm. I think of it this way: Paul standing before King Agrippa when he's accused of being crazy or mad, and you know, would you in so short a time think you could persuade King Agrippa to become a Christian? Paul says,
"Would that I could!
I wish that I could persuade everybody here." And then he says, "Because the king himself knows that what I've just reported to him, the namely the crucifixion and the resurrection of Jesus, did not happen in a corner."
Right.
And then neo-orthodoxy, Karl Barth, he didn't say this exactly, resurrection did happen in a metaphysical corner.
You
can only know it happened if you have faith first,
if
or the eyes of faith.
First.
Yep.
Yeah. You can only know whether it's true if you first believe that it's true. And that's different. I mean, I think the classic example sort of phrase that relates to this, that's used quite a bit to this day, is this idea of the Jesus of history and the Christ of faith.
Yep.
Yes.
Does this lead to sort of a problem with, accountability towards believing then, that somebody can't really be guilty if they don't believe it? Sort of like moving towards a universalism, or equality of religions.
And Rod, again, correct me. If I were to put the best construction on theologians like Barth and Bultmann and whatnot, I'd say that this is a result of, you know, being steeped in liberal theology, wanting to take a step towards orthodoxy, and believing that they were, but not really having the epistemological background to see that what they're doing is kind of nonsense.
Uh-huh. Do you think, in addition to that, there are also, like Barth, for example, trying to wall the faith off from scrutiny?
Absolutely.
So, kind of well-intentioned?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. Well, I think also the one thing that Rod used to say in the class is it sort of, in a lot of ways, got, it can get you, if you're a theologian and you want a seat back at the academic table, it can kind of get you there. Because you're in the realm of, in a sense, you know, I guess you're recounting myth, right? You're sort of you're myth maker, myth teller, which is fine. Just don't say that you're making absolute truth claims, verifiable truth claims. Otherwise, your seat's gone because you're not making truth claims. You're talking about metaphysics here. Mm. And while we're saying, no, actually, we're talking about a God who became man, dwelt among us, and did man stuff that was written down by other men and examining those claims.
Yep.
I seem to think in the history of Western universities, this is where you see the shift, and it takes decades, I'm sure, but from having theology departments to now religious studies departments, where religion's taken as a phenomenon,
right.
as opposed to a study of what God has revealed.
Yep. Right. Well, as a study of one of the legs in the epistemological stool, and the primary leg in the epistemological stool, and taken out of that, and it's sort of categorized into, like feminist studies.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, one of the critiques that I'm addressing in my MA is this, it's from a group of literature professors that says, hey, when theology is doing theology and making sort of claims from revelation, it then imposes too much over literature, art, you name it, story, whatever, because it's trying to make literature, the Bible, into some sort of truth claim, which it then can impose on the rest of the world.
But Rod, at the same time, I don't want to misrepresent it, because the new Orthodox theologian would not deny that these things occurred in history. They just
of a particular type.
Yes, the history it occurred in was of a particular type. And this is where the language game comes in. And this is where I think what the biggest critique of what happens is they start assigning particular religious meaning to commonly accepted terms like history.
Yep.
You know, and so that people
Germany, don't German know what you're talking has about. Two words for history. Mm-hmm. One is what you and I would call normal. Ford or Lincoln being shot at Ford's theater on a particular night, and the other German word is Geschichte, and that one is more slippery. If Bart were asked whether he believed that Christ rose again in history, he as a German would say, how are you using your English word history?
Right.
Because one of their words means true but not verifiable.
Yeah, like mythical history.
Well, you know what this always makes me think of is, the classic Christmas movie, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. During the song, you'll go down in history.
The term's Heilsgeschichte, right? This is a holy history.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Bart's term was Geschichte.
Yeah.
And it's very, 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 very real. But you couldn't verify it the same way as you could other events.
Right. It's above that.
Yeah.
Dr.
Montgomery said you can't tell whether poker games in Geschichte.
Yeah. Well, and if you're talking about the Christian faith, you can't really lower Christian faith to the level of being verified by actual history.
That's right.
It would do a disservice to the Christian faith.
Yep. And it is inevitably, in Bart's mind, it was inevitably to have to go back to fight all the old fights and come to...
They got them kind of kicked off the table anyway.
That's right.
In the first place.
That's right. Yeah. And Bultmann was even more laissez-faire about it. He said, all we need is Jesus' that-ness.
Yeah.
but a life was lived by that sometime.
But think
by somebody.
Of how much you, I mean, for our listeners, think of how much you hear, not that, you're not going to hear, all we need is Jesus' that-ness, but just think of how often you hear in your church things like that, essentially mean the same thing as that. All you need is Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What? Okay.
Oh yeah, that's
What do I need about Jesus? What Jesus? You can even say furthermore, what Jesus do I need?
Yeah.
And that's I think even in other traditions where you wouldn't hear that, you hear like, this is where we're going to participate with God, and you're like, okay, so.
Well, think of the thing that I think of when I hear the idea that to subject Christianity to real historical analysis would be lowering, bringing Christianity down. I think, well, I'm not doing that. That's what Jesus did for Pete's sake.
Yes, yes.
He did that himself.
Yeah.
And what Paul acknowledges that he did that.
Yep.
and tells us to do the same dang thing.
What we don't find in either of the authors or the ones like them in that era is lowering it to exactly what you said, because God did when he became man. Mm-hmm. He became visible, and all of the things that we associate with that, and they tried to use Geschichte to get around it.
Right. Yeah.
Well, when you said, you know, to give them the benefit of the doubt, or I think Adam said it, that they were trying to avoid sort of criticism of the faith.
Yeah.
You know, unfortunately, God invited a lot of criticism by becoming incarnate.
Yep.
Like, this is...
That's right.
Sort of, it opened itself up to sort
of... Paul tells us to critically analyze whether or not the resurrection actually happened.
Yes.
I mean, and this is the problem with it. Now, what I can't stand about this is this. This was essentially an academic argument that you can see sort of the motivations from the perspective of the academic, why they're having this argument, and how even from their perspective, how they think they're making a step in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
But it has wholesale been swallowed by modern sort of, I'll say, broad evangelical thought here as good.
Yeah.
As this is a good thing.
Yeah.
Without even knowing what they're doing or what they're saying or what the sort of history behind it is, you know, and these are people that think that they are, you know, conservative Bible-believing Christians who will say things like this.
That's right. And in case after case after case, historically speaking, when you have a solidly evangelical seminary, the first movement in the wrong direction, every one of them uses Barth.
That's right.
Yeah. Interesting.
That's right.
Everyone.
His influence, I mean, you cannot overestimate
his
influence in the 20th and 21st
modern
century.
Christianity. No.
No.
Yeah. And unless people think we're creating a banned book list, we're not. I'd say this is valuable stuff to read.
Yep.
You need to know this stuff if you're interested in these topics.
And when you read it, it's like you're reading some very orthodox, pious Christian. It's hard to, unless you know what you're looking for, it's hard to...
It can be hard to identify.
Yep. And it's on purpose.
You can see this, and I won't go into detail because I don't really want to get into this fight, but you can see this in people like Bonhoeffer to some degree. If you read not only just because, this is so great and I love it and he's a martyr. Yes, he's a martyr, and like you say, that's hard to criticize, but these categories are alive and well in Bonhoeffer.
Yeah.
These two types of language categories are alive and well there.
Yeah.
You ever read Barth in German?
No. maybe.
One sentence is... Like
a paragraph.
10-line long paragraph.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's true with the...
Ephesians 1.
Yeah.
You're going to have to breathe once or twice to get through the first sentence.
Yeah. I'd say that's true of most of the Germans, even in Latin.
Yeah. And I had to translate Barth for my German exam at Oxford. I'm surprised I passed.
That's funny. I translated Luther.
Yeah, I had that's a bit from Melanchthon.
Yeah.
And then Barth.
Just funny. That was probably perfect.
It was. It was piece of cake. Well, kind of, sort of.
Excursus, sorry.
Excursus, yeah. So where do we move on from here? Is it useful for people to identify if and when this is happening in their churches or in their own way that they're speaking? What's the alternative?
Well, I'd say let's just deal with in terms of the resurrection, okay? Because that's where the rubber meets the road here. If the resurrection didn't actually happen in real time, real space, and real history, you're probably SOL at the end of the day. And this is according to Paul.
Yeah.
So don't get mad at me here.
Yeah, First Corinthians 15.
Yeah, 15, 17. If he's not raised, you're still in your sin, man.
Yep.
And you're lying to yourself and you're lying to others, and
you're
most to be pitied, and that's not a good thing. So I think SOL is a pretty good description. If it didn't actually happen, so does it matter that it actually happened? It seems like it does.
Yeah.
Even Christ
seems.
Yeah. Even Christ seems to indicate that it actually matters that his apostles believe that he actually physically rose from the dead. And if it didn't, I don't know why he wasted that second trip into the 40, upper room to show himself to Thomas.
Yeah. Or 40 days following.
Or 40 days following. I mean, yep.
Or ate fish.
Or ate fish. It seems to matter that it actually happened.
Yep.
The belief in the actual, yes, this happened and it happened for me, and for all people, seems to be a kind of a, you know, an important deal in the scriptures. So the other thing that I think matters is that having a whole category of people who feel like it's okay to talk to you in technically nonsensical language,
yes,
and then to pay them to do it.
Yes.
I forget who it was. We, freshman year at Concordia in the core bio class, actually had to read. It was some scientist who had, you know, basically reproduced this. Who's, you know, I can be a Christian over here and a scientist over here, and none of the truth claims have to overlap for me.
Very common.
I can, you know, use materialistic language in the lab and and receive sort of the guilt poured off my conscience over here in the church live happily.
I had a biochemist who worked under Watson, Crick, and Salk at the Institute in La Jolla. Wonderful guy. And his solution to the problem of science and Christianity was he split his brain. Ooh. And I said, Rolf, I think I'm going to be the bearer of bad tidings.
Or good tidings.
Well, mine were that a split brain doesn't solve anything.
No. Yeah, but the good tidings are the follow-up. But good news, this stuff isn't actually what you've been taught it is. It's not actually some sort of mythical history that you just have to accept on faith.
Yep.
This stuff actually happened.
Yep.
Well, I think
and can be analyzed in the way that you would analyze any other event that occurred in history.
Yep.
Well, and I think Rod's point that, you know, maybe could just get spelled out is at some point the problem that made you split your brain is going to come back up again, and it's going to be your faith that suffers here.
Yeah.
Well, Crick and Watson, they're double helix people for DNA, right?
Mm-hmm.
This supposedly they came to the discovery over a few beers in a tavern in Cambridge, right? Scratched on a napkin.
It could be. The part I remember was they were trying to figure it out, and they had to walk up to their bedrooms.
On the spiral staircase.
On the spiral staircase.
Yeah. Huh. I mean, that's an important historical event, right?
I think.
Yeah. I mean, and this stuff, that can be analyzed. That could be investigated. People could be asked. Their testimony could be surveyed.
Yeah.
This is the same thing. This is the same thing. I mean, a person that's working with them probably has some sense of whether that story, as we know it, is true or false, right? And because they've spoken to them, because they've analyzed it, the whole nine yards. And I think this is the same thing. If you take it out of that, you then make it actually technically meaningless. You make the resurrection completely unverifiable. Yep. If it's unverifiable to history, it's unverifiable whether it does anything for me or not.
Uh-huh.
Because if he didn't raise, he's not God.
It's exactly what 1 Corinthians 15 argues.
And this death is just another death.
Yeah.
So I think this religious language is terribly damaging, and I can't stand how often I hear it even among our friends.
Yeah.
Honestly. Yeah. This came up for me when I was at a conference of a group that I really like. I think they do great work, but they had a speaker who was very neo-Orthodox and very much used this two types of language stuff to explain the atonement. Mm-hmm. For Pete's sake.
Well, when we were in Norway, we, you know, tried to distinguish between, you know, why Christianity, why the forgiveness of Christ isn't just therapeutic religion for the sake of being therapeutic. And if you play this game, one form of therapy might be better than the other, regardless of sort of if it's the forgiveness of sins or not.
I was gonna mention something along these lines. What I oftentimes contrast it with, if the resurrection is ultimately unverifiable, or if you put it in that category, you've reduced the foundation, the epistemic, if you will, foundation in terms of its truth value of Christianity to being similar to every other religion out there. I mean, all of a sudden now Christianity has as much going for it in terms of our ability to know whether it's true or not as Buddhism.
Yep.
Or maybe even Scientology.
Yep.
So it's tremendously harmful.
Which, I mean, then brings up, I mean, you see people talk about how hypocritical Christians are, and if it really is in the realm of a lot of these other religions, you can get to that very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. sort of how a lot of Christian philanthropies actually self-centered or something like that. You could stack up the deeds of Christians against the deeds of
sure.
Buddhists or
sure.
something like
it's wide
that,
open.
And come up really wanting.
Yep.
And it makes a lot of sense that's a lot of when you hear the world. If you go to somebody secular, and I'm sure you guys hear this at the university a lot, because I heard it just among my peers, is Christians are hypocrites. Christians are hypocrites.
Sure.
Christians are hypocrites. Well, what are they focusing on? They're focusing on sort of this: is it therapeutic? Does it do good in the world?
Yep.
Does it claim to do good in the world?
Yep.
And all of a sudden, that's sort of the measure of its authenticity or its claim to any sort of value, in not whether Christ raised from the dead or not.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unfortunately a race we might not be winning on that other side anyways.
Yeah, it's there have been people in ages past, Christians, in ages past, who were serious when they said to their opponents, where is your leader now? Mm. And the answer is in a grave somewhere,
yeah.
marked or unmarked.
I was just thinking that, you can even see some of this in Ferdy, to be honest with you. But in Ferdy, it comes out in a, I wouldn't say an explicitly existential approach, but a, say, majoritively existential approach to the benefits of the resurrection. And my answer to that would be, listen, I think there are existential benefits to the resurrection. Sure. I just think that they're only verified by the actual event of the resurrection and
That's
what
right.
Christ says it does for me.
That's right, or they collapse with
it. Or they collapse with it. That if the one didn't happen, the existential benefit has no grounding.
And, yep.
it's got no more benefit than Buddhism or anything else at that point. But if Christ rose from the dead, he's God. If he's God, I listen to what he says. He says there are benefits to you in your life now, in your heart now, and the whole nine yards, things that I can't on my own verify.
Well, yep. Once that one thing, I mean, this is the thing. Once that one thing is dealt with, the death and resurrection of Christ, you are now freed to then talk about those existential, those personal benefits endlessly to the person, to sort of keep on declaring those things, because this issue which would destroy the whole thing is now you're actually free to talk like
totally that. Agree. I just don't ever think we can stop talking about the actual yep. fact that this happened in real time, space, and history.
Yep.
Because
and Schaefer agrees,
and everything, because then everything else is lost, all the other benefits are lost.
Yeah. And especially in the writings of Dr. Montgomery, you see yep. this done 43 ways from Friday. He will not let go of it.
So, yeah, no, I don't like religious language.
I just don't think it's just not a strong position.
No, but it's the position. I yeah. mean, most Christians hold this position, I think, to be honest with you.
Wittgenstein.
In one way or another.
Wittgenstein was Jewish, probably unbelieving Jewish. But he would have been able to follow this, and it would have counted for him. Yeah. It wouldn't take very long in him for him to say that it counted. I think of one of his remarks when he was talking about ethics, and he said, there is no such thing as ethics unless you had a book from heaven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Divine decree, baby. Yeah. But one has to verify that this is actually a divine decree.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sure, and he would understand that language.
Yes.
He'd be fascinated.
There's a Norman Malcolm.
Yep.
Wittgenstein's
good friend.
Great student, and
yep.
I think he taught at Cornell.
He did. John studied under him.
Well, he records in his book, Wittgenstein, A Religious Point of View, question
yep.
mark, that they were walking in a garden at some point, and
yep.
I guess a conversation came up about the resurrection and the verification of Christianity, and I guess Wittgenstein stopped and he said, well, if it did happen, that would change everything.
That's right. He did. He said that to Malcolm. Well, if it did, it would change everything.
Sounds a lot like Paul, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. Well, guys, that's...
The correlative is Paul's statement, if it didn't.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are we? We're at time. Is there anything else we need to include before I close out the show?
The only thing I'd say is that we promised to sort of give the three categories, which we've done before.
we did a whole episode on it that I can link.
That they can link.
In fact,
yeah. We just sort of referred to them.
Yeah.
Well, it's good to know that it's very easy to be conned in religious language by people who are a more liberal bent from the 19th century through the 20th, that you could be being conned.
Well, yeah, and I think just say thank you to Rod for teaching that class for all these years that he couldn't stand teaching, but that
I think we've said
obviously helpful.
For there have been episodes in years past where we talked about our greatest not life-changing moments, but influences in terms of our education. I remember a couple moments where you and I both said that distinction.
Oh,
I mean, there were other things you taught us, but that distinction made all the difference.
Yeah.
In some ways, it's not necessarily for the better. Like, I find myself, because I really like that last thesis in Wittgenstein's Tractatus. If you can't speak to something, just let it pass
be
over.
Quiet.
In silence.
Yeah.
And so there's times where I have nothing to say,
uh-huh.
You know, and I feel socially awkward. I'm already awkward enough as it is, and I don't have a whole lot to say.
Sure.
But it's helpful for cutting through all the synonym for malarkey.
Yeah, yeah. And I think for theologians, that same thing is really helpful. I said before the show that I do this class quite a bit called Epistemology of Theology, and the last thing I say in that class is that a good theologian stops where the text stops.
Yeah.
You know, where the text doesn't speak, you ought not speak either.
Yeah. It's sort of the pain of being Lutheran, and, is that, actually.
Yeah. And one more thing I want to mention. There's a great, in Montgomery's Tractatus, the last thesis there is, if you can, this is me.
Yeah.
If you can speak, you must.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great way to end that great apologetic work.
Yep.
Well, cool. I like ending that the episode on that as well. So, hey, guys, thank you for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoy it. Like I said, this is the Tuesday following Here We Still Stand. This is a busy time for us. You should sign up for next year, but you should also look for the episodes that are coming from that. We always take Here We Still Stand as a large recording opportunity. We record one live podcast that will be coming out soon, and then we also tend to record podcasts in a side room during that time too, because there's so many people who travel, or you have the opportunity to maybe have them on a show once every year or once every other year or something like that. And so we're definitely going to do that. We did do that, and we're going to release those episodes soon. So please hang tight with us. And then following that, we're going to be in the holiday season, which sort of makes recording schedules interesting, and then we'll try to do some...
I mean, talk about special types of language. You're talking about the future as though it's in the past.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah,
that's exactly
I'm confused
right.
Now.
Hey, again, thank you for listening to this episode. We'll catch you next time.
Bye.
Bye.